We are joined here live in the KODX studios by Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. We'll be going to local news, but prior to that, while we were all heading this way to the studios, it turns out there's been another mass shooting this week, this one in El Paso.
Yeah, and that's the emphasis of another one. It's the third one this week, the second major one after Gilroy last weekend. And unconfirmed reports of up to 18 fatalities in a Walmart and a shopping mall in El Paso. A 21-year-old male is in custody. He may or may not have had accomplices.
Remember, El Paso is right there on the border, so part of the whole border.
This mall is 5 miles from the border.
Yeah.
It's just east of downtown.
Part of the whole current debate over whether or not to allow immigrants into the United States, period.
And also El Paso has two major military bases mm-hmm. adjacent to it.
Yeah.
And that may be a factor as well. We don't know anything about motives yet. There is a photo circulating on social media, allegedly of the shooter on Snapshot, showing off his gun collection, which wouldn't be surprising. The Gilroy shooter was a 19-year-old white male who apparently fell down the rabbit hole of extreme white nationalist websites. And, the El Paso shooter allegedly is 21 years old. It's a dangerous age range. There is nothing that our political leadership in this country is doing about it, and everything that our president in particular is doing to try and exacerbate the problem. This is going to keep happening, unfortunately. It's, not much more can be said than that.
And second shooting this week at a Walmart.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. Well, for those folks who don't buy everything online, Walmart is where a lot of Americans go.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm sure it was quite crowded on a Saturday
mm-hmm.
afternoon.
Yep.
And, or midday local time. And they also made a decision about a year ago, I think, to stop selling guns in Walmart.
Yeah.
And who knows whether that's related or not. But, it's just really unfortunate all the way around.
All right. Now switching over to local.
Yes.
And we are just days away from the final official election day.
Yes. Yeah. Your ballots have to be in by Tuesday. They have to be postmarked by Tuesday. The earlier the better, since the state is switching to a new election system and hasn't gotten all the kinks worked out yet. They do that on off years intentionally because it's a lower turnout.
You should probably mail them today if you're going to mail them. There are ballot boxes where you can drop off your ballots. In fact, I think here in the University District, the ballot drop box is right outside Schmitz Hall, which is University Way Northeast and about 41st Street.
Yeah, I believe there's also mm-hmm. one at the community center that's, I think, 4534 University Way Northeast.
Mm-hmm. And you can register in person and vote right up until 8 p.m. on Tuesday, August 6th. But like I say, you have to do it in person. You can go down to the King County Administration Building at 500 4th Avenue, room 440, between Jefferson and James Streets off 4th Avenue downtown. You can do that either on Monday or you can do that Tuesday right up until 8 p.m.
And is that room going to be air-conditioned? Because I'm thinking Monday that's going
to be pretty
a
hot.
Real attractive
yeah, my,
perk.
Yeah, my guess is the King County Administration Building probably does have air conditioning.
I know the county council chambers do.
Yeah.
Funny now, how that works.
Yeah.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about PAC spending in the city council races, give everybody an update. CASE, the Civic Alliance for a Sound Economy, which is the Seattle Chamber of Commerce PAC, has raised over $1 million, $1,033,226, according to their recent filing. And they've spent two-thirds of that, about $682,000, mostly to support their candidates, especially Phil Tavel in District 1, Mark Solomon in District 2, and Egan O'Ryan in District 3 to overturn the current incumbents, Lisa Herbold in District 1, Shama Swant in District 3, and to keep Tammy Morales out of the final election in District 2.
And I want to emphasize that $600,000... an average council
almost
race,
almost
700,000, represents up until, I would say the last 4 years or so, pretty much double the record for city council spending for the general election, let alone the primary.
Yeah.
So it's an unprecedented amount of money.
Yeah. Now, they've purchased quite a bit of digital advertising, but they've also been paying for canvassing, so paying people to go out and knock on doors for those three candidates, Phil Tavel, Mark Solomon, and Egan O'Ryan, because apparently they can't get enough volunteers to actually do that. Now, they've also spent money on hit pieces or negative mailers against Lisa Herbold in District 1 and Shama Sawant in District 3. Their biggest contributors are still Amazon at $250,000, Vulcan at $155,000, the Washington Association of Realtors at $120,000, Expedia at $50,000, and NIOP, that's the Commercial Real Estate Development Association, at $45,000. But also the big real estate companies, Hadrian Holdings and RC Hadrian Company, have given them $80,000 too. Puget Sound Energy and Comcast Cable have given them $30,000, and then a whole bunch of other real estate companies like the Azola Group, Washington Retail Association, PAC, and big businesses like Weyerhaeuser, Alaska Airlines, Boeing, AT&T, Wright-Runstead, they're big developers, the Building Owners and Managers Association, PAC, Kleist Properties, Associated General Contractors of Washington, and on and on and on are the supporters, main supporters here in the city of Seattle for the Chamber of Commerce PAC.
I can't imagine why real estate developers would feel a special stake in this election.
Yeah, why they, and it's interesting why they would be against Shama Sawant, since she's for upzoning District 3 and for developers building more housing. But she has a caveat to that that's very, very important, which is that those rental units must be affordable, and she's pushing for rent control.
Yeah.
And that's why they hate
her. Yeah, and the rent control is a pretty central feature of a re-election campaign.
Yeah.
So no wonder.
So now another PAC, Rich People for Seattle is what I call them. They call themselves People for Seattle. It's the group started by Tim Burgess and individuals behind the companies that have been giving to the Case PAC. They've raised about $292,000, and they've spent almost two-thirds of it, about $191,000. They've spent a little money to support the Chamber of Commerce's candidates like Phil Tavel, Mark Solomon, Egan O'Ryan, and in addition, Alex Peterson in District 4. But most of their money has gone into mailers against Lisa Herbold, Shama Sawant, and Zachary DeWolf in District 3, Emily Myers in District 4, and Tammy Morales in District 2. But they've also made recent payments for phone calls against Lisa Herbold in District 1. And that's how desperate Tim Burgess is to get one of his former colleagues off of the city council. Now, go ahead, Mike.
Oh, I was going to say, did you see the notice this week regarding Lisa Herbold and People for Seattle that Carmen Best has made a request officially to have her image removed from People from Seattle's flyers, insinuating that she is...
Good for her.
You know, yeah, so. No, she specifically said, I have not endorsed anybody. I don't endorse anybody. That's not what we do.
Yeah, that's good. I wish Mayor Durkin had done the same thing before sending out emails that called Tammy Morales a socialist when she's not.
Well, she clearly does endorse people.
Yeah, and she does endorse people. So I think that was a really good move by Carmen Best. Now, Rich People for Seattle has also made some big recent consulting payments to Tim Seiss and Ryan Bain of CBE Strategies, as well as Sandeep Kaushik of Soundview Strategies. And it looks like they've committed some big payments for digital advertising and more emails to go out.
And Sandeep in particular has worked with Jenny Durkin. Tim Seiss is in and out of Durkin's office
mm-hmm.
frequently.
Yeah.
He's also a paid lobbyist for a number of groups.
Oh, yeah, for a number of big
corporations. So, this is all big business.
Yeah, and their biggest donors include a whole lot of Amazon executives, real estate mogul Richard Hadrian, and several members of the Macaw Cellular dynasty, as well as John Stanton. He's another wireless millionaire and owner of the Seattle Mariners, Fortune 500 executive Paula Rossput Reynolds, commercial real estate mogul Al Kleist of Kleist Properties, Brad Tilden, who's the CEO of Alaska Airlines, and his wife, Danielle, who likes to pretend that she's a small business owner, and members of the big Wright real estate dynasty, who are the owners of the Space Needle Corporation, and a whole lot of other real estate developers. Those are the people, quote unquote, people for Seattle. I call them rich people for Seattle.
Yes. So can we talk for a minute about a few moms and a whole bunch of white guys?
That's next on my list.
Oh, God.
Did you have a question, Mike?
No, I was just going to say there's some overlap, too, between People for Seattle
and
the Chamber in terms of contributions from both companies and individuals.
Yeah, and as well as the
covering
candidates.
Covering their bases.
Yeah, as well as the candidates they support. And which is interesting because Case, the Chamber of Commerce PAC, has been doing mostly flyers in support of those candidates. Rich People for Seattle have been doing flyers, phone calling, canvassing, et cetera, against their opponents, the more progressive candidates in the race. That's kind of how they've split their money. Now, the third group I want to talk about is Moms for Seattle. I call them Rich Moms for Seattle. The Stranger's blog has run some really interesting articles about who's behind Moms for Seattle.
Yes, they have.
And they conclude that it's a public relations firm, Strategies 360, which is also doing consulting work for the Seattle Chamber of Commerce PAC and has worked for Ed Murray and consulted on Jenny Durkin's campaign. And the Sightline Institute describes Strategies 360 as perhaps the major public relations firm behind big oil and gas projects in the Puget Sound area. Now, Rich Moms for Seattle has raised about $187,000, and they've spent all but $30,000 of that, so about 84% of it for this primary race. They've become really notorious this week for sending out the mailer that includes a photo of a child's swing with piles of trash, a wall with graffiti on it, and a tent in the background suggesting that this is Cowan Park. And the caption reads, quote, "This isn't how people should be living or where children should be playing." However, it's not where children are playing because that's a fake photo. It was photoshopped together from at least three separate pictures.
All of which were stock photos.
Yeah, the pile of trash is from one stock photo and the tent is from a separate stock photo. Rich Moms for Seattle combined all these elements with the child's swing in order to scare people because, of course, they couldn't find a real scary photo. In fact, they told,
Essex Porter, I believe.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what media outlet I read this in. They told a recent report, I think maybe it was the Seattle Times, that they had taken a whole bunch of photos of homeless people in parks, but they didn't want to use those photos ostensibly because they had people in them. And they didn't give a further reason behind that. And my feeling is, yeah, they have people in them. Therefore, people will sympathize with the people in those photos and not necessarily agree with your message.
Maybe they couldn't get a photo release.
And I guess if you're Rich Moms for Seattle, it's just, you know, better to take photos of icky stuff and have people be against icky stuff.
And I think it's highly likely that Strategies 360 put those mailers together, found the stock photos,
yes,
and intentionally tried to scare and mislead. It's a very Trumpian kind of tactic.
Yeah. No, I'm sure.
Look at the scary people.
No, I'm sure that Strategies 360 has been spending quite a bit of money to put together these. They're a public relations firm to put together the right kind of photo to send the right kind of message.
And those mailers went out to multiple candidates. They went out mostly to Case-endorsed candidates, except in District 3, where they were sent out on behalf of Pat Murakami rather than Egan O'Brien.
Yeah.
That's
the one difference in endorsements between Rich Moms and Case.
And it's not entirely clear why the candidates that were sent out on behalf of haven't been disavowing these photos because it's now been very
because
widely.
They can. Yeah.
Yeah, they've been very widely and publicly reported to be fake.
Yeah.
And you know, I would be embarrassed if I were, say, Pat Murakami.
And I would ask them to stop.
And I would ask them to stop, yeah. And I would say, I had nothing to do with this. I had no control over it.
Yeah, instead, I believe the Seattle Times asked Phil Tavel. They said, well, do you agree with these fake photos going out on your behalf? And he just kind of shrugged his shoulders and said, well, I just have to tell people that, you know, those are the PACs and I have no control over them, which is a lie.
That's a statement worthy of disqualification from the city council.
Yeah,
Strategies 360 is also specializes in crisis management, and they were initially brought in when the KOW's attempted acquisition of KPLU hit the fan, mm-hmm. and they were one of the firms brought in for a while, and eventually let go because the KOW didn't agree
failed.
With their strategy. So.
Yeah, didn't agree with their strategy, which probably was cut off negotiations and just go forward with the deal. Yeah. No, Strategies 360 does build themselves as helping you manage crises. And they do have a tendency to work with the most conservative, sleaziest businesses out there.
And they also tend to be very anti-labor.
Yeah, I'm very anti-labor. Now, there are some progressive PACs in the race. The SEIU 775 has collected a lot of money. They've raised almost $500,000, but they've spent only about a third of that, $166,000. But that includes contributions that they've made to candidates all over the state of Washington, including races in Tacoma, Spokane, SeaTac, Auburn, Federal Way, Tukwila, Burien, and other cities. They have put about $5,000 in the city of Seattle. They have put about $5,000 into digital ads for Lisa Herbold and Tammy Morales, and about $12,600 into digital ads for Jay Fothy in District 6. And they made a $10,000 contribution each to two other PACs, CAPE, the Civic Alliance for a Progressive Economy, and to Working People for an Affordable Seattle. Now, those two groups have spent money to support candidates. Working People for an Affordable Seattle has spent about $14,000 supporting Emily Myers in District 4, and she's really the only candidate that they're supporting at the at this time. And CAPE, the Civic Alliance for a Progressive Economy, is spending around $50,000 to support Lisa Herbold in District 1 and Tammy Morales in District 2, including sending out mailers against Tavel and Colding in District 1 and against Solomon and Hoffman in District 2. So there is a little bit work on behalf of progressive candidates, both for and against candidates in those two district races.
Yeah, and this weekend I'll repost my recommendations for the races, but it should be pretty clear from our descriptions here what some of those recommendations might be.
Yeah. Now, I also want to point out, too, that CAPE, Civic Alliance for a Progressive Economy, is the only progressive one that appears to be really opposing candidates, and that includes some digital online ads. I just also want to remind people that the majority of the money in CAPE is from millionaire Nick Hanauer and his two groups, Civic Ventures and Civic Action. A full 73% of their money comes from that source alone. And the remainder of it is mostly that one donation from the SEIU 775. So it looks like he and his groups are really directing the activities of CAPE. And of course, there's the Unite Here Local 8 PAC. That's the Hotel Workers Union, which has raised and spent about $150,000 for Andrew Lewis in District 7.
All right. Mm-hmm. Anything else on that?
Nope.
Okay.
Yeah, it should be clear from all of this that certainly big business in Seattle sees this as a pivotal election and a chance to flip the council to being more business-friendly and more reliable allies to Mayor Durkin's agenda. And if you have some problems with that agenda, get out and vote. Actually, get out and vote regardless.
You should be voting but, regardless.
Yeah. Yes, but this really is one of the more hotly contested primaries in recent Seattle political history.
All right, moving on briefly, a new Speaker of the House in the state level.
Yeah, Frank Chopp has officially resigned as Speaker of the Washington State House after 20 years in that role, although he is still going to be a representative for the 43rd District here in Seattle. The new speaker is a Democrat from Tacoma named Lori Jenkins. She was elected to the state house in 2010 and took office in January 2011. Before that, she chaired the Tacoma Hate Crimes Task Force and led the statewide campaign to approve Referendum 71, the domestic partnership law. Jenkins is gay and was the first openly gay woman elected to the Washington State Legislature. She currently serves on the Appropriations Committee, the Health Care and Wellness Committee, and is the chair of the Judiciary Committee. She's also served on the Capital Budget, on the Environment, and the Transportation Committees. She spent the last session working on reform to the state mental health care system and getting the Long-Term Health Care Act passed, which set up a state fund to pay for long-term care expenses for state residents, funded with a very small payroll tax. She also helped pass bills to reform the eviction laws in Washington State on behalf of renters. So this is a real change, I think, from the old-style conservative Democrat that Frank Chopp is, who would often kill really good progressive bills before they could reach the floor of the House. He would let them pass through committee, but then when he was supposed to bring them up for discussion or in a vote on the floor, he just wouldn't do it.
Yeah, which is at odds with the 43rd District, which is now what he would be the sole representative of, which is probably one of the most liberal districts in the state.
Yeah, and he was particularly bad in recent years on tax reform and gun control legislation, two very important issues before our state legislature. Jenkins, on the other hand, has repeatedly introduced a capital gains tax bill in the House every year for the last 7 years. So tax reform is high on her list of items to tackle. And because she's a lawyer by training, she does know what's going to pass muster with the state constitution and the state Supreme Court, and what won't.
And when I should say also that even before Chop announced that he would be stepping down, for the last year or so, there have been multiple Democrats angling for that speaker job, so that Jenkins was able to get it says something about her level of political skill.
Yeah.
She will be a force.
Yeah. And I think it also says something about the intentions of the state Democrats to try to reform how the party works on the inside, to be more inclusive, more collaborative, and to not shut out women and people of color as it has often in the past.
Okay. So that sounds like our single good news item for the week.
Could yeah, be. It is actually
and,
good
and
news.
I think some of that reform pressure in the Democrat Party at the state level can be traced directly to the Sanders campaign 3 years ago and the number of people that it inspired to get involved that have been pressuring the Democrats internally since then for reform. And this is a fairly major victory on that behalf.
All right. Well, back to bad news, certainly for people in Bristol Bay.
Yeah, and for the people in Seattle who are involved in the North Pacific Fishing Fleet, somewhat catastrophic news, actually. The EPA reversed the agency's own Seattle-based scientists, which spent years researching the potential environmental impact and taking public comments on a huge proposed copper and gold mine in southwest Alaska in a very remote area called Bristol Bay. It's about, 500-600 miles southwest of Anchorage. It's largely wilderness in that region, and for anybody who knows anything about modern copper and gold mining, they basically terraform the area they're interested in and don't leave much except dirt and tailings.
These huge toxic these huge toxic ponds that contain a lot of heavy metals that would kill wildlife if and does often occur. Those barriers between the pond and nearby streams fail.
And this is a region that sees a lot of extreme weather.
Yeah.
Both in terms of temperature and in terms of ferocious storms coming off the Bering Sea.
And Bristol Bay and the headwaters of the Bristol Bay are extremely important for what is the largest sockeye salmon run in the world now, fed by the headwaters of the Bristol Bay. So allowing mining there could wipe out the last really, truly big run of sockeye salmon, at least in the western part of the United States, but in the world.
So after all that review of environmental impact and potential comments, public comments, et cetera, the scientists based in Seattle recently submitted a highly critical review of the mining proposal, and the Clean Water Act gives regional EPA administrators authority to step in when they determine proposed projects would likely damage fisheries or wildlife habitat.
And they did that in 2014,
which clearly,
right?
This would, yes. Yeah. Chris Hladek, the EPA regional administrator here in Seattle, had found weaknesses in an Army Corps draft environmental impact statement, writing on July 1st that it likely underestimated adverse impacts on water quality and fish resources. But Hladek was directed by a top EPA official last month to consider whether to withdraw the agency's veto option, and decided on Tuesday that he would do so. So this is something that came from the top down, from the EPA political appointees, likely in Washington, D.C. And it's yet another victory for the Trump administration's priority of making sure that the federal government gets out of the regulatory business entirely.
Yeah, even if it means destroying some very important pieces of our natural environment.
Yes, and we've seen this not only with the Clean Water Act, we've seen it with air quality, we've seen it with countless other certainly environmental things. We saw a new acting director this week in the Bureau of Land Management who has said publicly that he doesn't believe the federal government should be owning land, that it should all be in the hand of private landowners. Now he has the opportunity with the BLM, which owns vast amounts of land, not only in Washington State, but throughout the Mountain West and Pacific Coast.
Wait a minute. Wasn't it a Republican, Teddy Roosevelt, who was huge behind our national park system.
Yes, and of course, national parks would be something that would be auctioned off too in this guy's vision. But fortunately, he doesn't have jurisdiction over that, just over the BLM. But yeah, that's the idea. Everything should be open to oil and gas resources, which of course is what's driving a lot of this, along with mining and grazing and ranching interests. But again underscores that the Trump administration, everything is up for sale. Yeah. Everything that is paid for by tax dollars is up for sale to Trump and his buddies. We saw another nominee withdrawn this week after it turns out he this is for the Director of National Intelligence, which is a key national security post. Trump had named a guy named Mark Radcliffe, who is a congressman who is an avid Trump fan, but didn't really have any intelligence background. He claimed intelligence background, but it turns out that part of his resume was all lies. And Trump, when confronted about this and withdrawing the nomination yesterday, said, well, you guys do my vetting for me so I can save all the kinds of money, which is one of the most cockeyed explanations for Trump's lack of vetting I can imagine.
That's probably the laziest thing I've ever heard.
This is the 36th different nominee that the Trump administration has had to withdraw because of potential conflicts of interest, ethical violations, et cetera, et cetera.
And because they just don't vet them.
They don't.
So he's just admitted that they don't do any vetting at all.
No, apparently they don't. He vets them on the basis of how personally loyal he thinks they are to him. Mm-hmm. And of course, we've seen what that can result in with the Attorney General and various other appointees.
Okay, so I think that would be, you know, now that we have a majority of Democrats in the House that say they're willing to impeach Trump, I think the rest of the Democrats have no excuse to not sign on to that in light of the fact that Donald Trump is clearly not doing a very important and key part of his job there.
Yeah, and that's not Social Security. That's something that even Republicans ostensibly care about.
Yeah.
And that apparently is what killed this nomination, is that a number of Senate Republicans were skittish on this because they didn't think he was qualified. But at the same time, it underscores how important it is to get Democrats controlling the Senate next year so that they can stop some of these nominees, or at least the ones that aren't acting directors, mm-hmm. Which seems to be most of them these days. So that was depressing. Should we move on to the next depressing thing?
And looking at my notes, I realized we had two good news items this week.
Oh, okay.
So sorry that I set everybody's expectations. It's a roller coaster. There was a good development yesterday with a federal judge throwing out one of the Trump administration policies regarding immigrants.
Yes, D.C. Court of Appeals Federal Judge Randolph Mass, who was an Obama appointee, one of the few that managed to get through under Mitch McConnell after 2010, yesterday he threw out a Trump administration policy that basically would have abolished the asylum system that is currently in place under law, which Judge Moss took pains to note that it was law and it was Congress's responsibility to change that law, not Trump unilaterally. Finding that it violated the Immigration and Nationality Act. All of this crisis on the border of on asylum seekers is blatantly illegal because there is a set process in place for asylum seekers legally entering this country and having their cases for asylum being heard. Now, historically, coming from authoritarian regimes in Central America, the United States has not honored those asylum requests, but that's very different from simply trying to unilaterally deport or first torture and then deport asylum seekers.
All asylum seekers.
All asylum seekers.
And that's what,
including small children.
That's what the Trump administration is doing. And again, you know, this judge is saying that the Trump administration is violating the law.
Yep.
When you have a president that won't uphold the law, which is probably his key responsibility as president of the United States, then it's incumbent on Congress to impeach him.
Yeah, and speaking of upholding the law, I think they're up to like 25 or 26 different subpoenas from Congress that the Trump administration has simply ignored.
Yeah.
And that's a violation of law as well.
As well, yep, yep.
And those are slowly winding their way through the courts, although at this point, the courts have unilaterally ruled in favor of the House of Representatives
on
that score.
I think this week, Pramila Jayapal admitted to the press that, yes, the House is beginning impeachment the impeachment process, actually. And I think it's in the either in the Oversight Reform or the Judiciary Committee.
It was the Judiciary
the
Committee.
Judiciary
she
committee,
sits on the Judiciary Committee.
Yeah,
so
that's
she's
right.
in a position to know.
Yeah, you're correct.
All right. Well, sticking with the concept of Democrats and potential replacements for the current resident of the
White House,
most expensive public housing in the U.S. I know you were both glued to the tube at least one of the nights this last
week. Yeah, I watched the first night of the debates and could not get the time or the energy to watch the second night.
I watched them both because I couldn't find a brick wall to pound my head on the second night instead. So I did something nearly as painful and just about as tedious.
Yeah.
I was not impressed with the debates this time around. Marie and I were talking before the show. We were both appalled by the CNN moderators, particularly on the first night. They were just wretched.
Yeah. And I just have a few takeaways from watching the first night. My first one is, why waste time on opening statements? That was a major mistake, because essentially the candidates are just repeating what they repeat on the campaign trail, and you're not getting any additional information out of them.
And not only that, but between the opening statements and the closing statements, it took nearly half the time that was available for talking about issues.
Yeah, no, it's a total waste of time to do that. Now, my second takeaway is that CNN structured the debate as an attack. This is the first night on the two progressive candidates, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. And I just scribbled down some of the questions that they kept asking the more conservative candidates to try to get them to attack Sanders and Warren. So here's just a quick list of a few of them. Are you not willing to fight for Medicare for all, as Senator Warren has suggested? Do you think decriminalizing border crossings will encourage illegal immigration? Will Senator Sanders' immigration proposals encourage more undocumented immigrants to come to the U.S.? Do you believe Senator Sanders is too extreme to beat Trump? Are Democrats moving too far to the left to win the White House? Who on this stage is making promises just to get elected? They asked Amy Klobuchar that. Why is the Green New Deal not realistic? And on and on and on. These are just a few of the questions that they asked.
And it was very much, let's you and him or her, as the case may be, fight.
Yeah.
They were really trying to pit the Democrats against each other. And it worked, because that's how the questions were structured.
Yeah. And I literally thought, you know, is this debate being hosted by Breitbart News?
Yeah. And
seriously.
So on the first night, but even more so on the second night, Trump was barely mentioned at all.
Yeah.
And some of this was the situation, because the standards for qualifying for the debate change after this debate. They take August off, but the next debate in September, only seven, I think possibly eight now, candidates have qualified for it, and not that many more have a shot at qualifying, honestly. So it'll be a much smaller debate and hopefully more manageable next time. But it was incumbent on the lesser-known candidates to try and make a name for themselves, and they were doing that by attacking the better-known candidates. And my major takeaway from the first night was I thought both Sanders and Warren acquitted themselves extremely well, but the top five candidates, and I would include Klobuchar and Beto O'Rourke, and I forget who else was on that
Buttigieg.
First night. Buttigieg. They were clearly far better prepared and much smoother in their responses than the bottom five candidates. Mm. There's a reason those candidates' campaigns have not drawn a lot of support. They're not very good, honestly.
Yeah, so just going back to the hosts of the debate, CNN, I just want to remind folks that CNN was originally founded by conservative millionaire Ted Turner as the first 24/7 cable news channel to broadcast continuous breaking news, and much of it was sensationalistic. CNN is now owned by AT&T's Warner Media division. And in the 2016 presidential election, CNN took a lot of criticism for giving a lot more airtime to Donald Trump than to the other Republican candidates, and also giving far more airtime to Hillary Clinton than to Bernie Sanders. And CNN replied to that saying, well, you know, those are the two candidates that always agreed to give interviews. So we always aired them. Okay, so now my feeling is that CNN is one of those stations that really is as bad as Fox News, perhaps worse, in that they tend to present themselves as the moderate choice in news. And I really feel like, no, they are not the moderate choice. And this time around, it really confirmed it for me. But I also want to point out, too, that the mainstream media in general have been saying just regularly that this year's Democrats are further to the left than is normal. And I just want to point out that that is not true, that, in fact, this year's Democrats are returning to really what is the base of the Democratic Party before channels like CNN came on the air and started playing a major role in moving the entirety of the U.S. political system far to the right, as they have been.
Yes, because what has happened over the past 20 years is that while the Republicans take every setback as instructive in their terms of, well, we need to have a purer form of conservatism, every time the Democrats have a setback, all of the talking heads in mainstream media tell them, well, you have to become more moderate. You have to appeal to mm-hmm. crossover Republicans. And as we saw with Clinton and the DLC and the whole third way, that really was the dominant corporate model within the Democratic Party for a number of years. And there's still a significant strain
starting
there.
Starting with Bill Clinton, I think.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, as for the candidates on night one, I think Elizabeth Warren was the standout. Bernie Sanders did better than he did in the first debate, but I think Warren got in more zingers and much better answers to some truly awful questions posted by the CNN moderators.
She slapped down John Delaney hard a couple times.
Yeah, that doesn't
mean... It was a thing of beauty.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that she's the better candidate. It just means that she's the better in the debate format. So I encourage people to look at the issues if you're going to decide between Warren and Sanders.
Now, yeah, and I thought Sanders did quite well also.
Yeah, now Pete Buttigieg has this very calm charisma that stood out, I think, next to Bernie Sanders, who's a little louder and gesticulates more. But Buttigieg's policies are also very conservative, as far as I can tell. And I think the big losers of the night were Steve Bullock, who sputtered a lot and came across as an arrogant good old boy, and Tim Ryan, who spoke the least of all the candidates. And I really can't remember anything that he said. Both Bullock and John Delaney, as well as Tim Ryan, really came across as more Republicans who've decided to join the Democratic Party because the Republican Party under Donald Trump is now really the Nazi Party. And I really felt that when Marianne Williamson said, I think there are some candidates on the stage who are not Democrats, she was right that Bullock and Ryan and Delaney really would be part of the Republican mainstream if the Republican Party wasn't so extreme now.
Yeah, even 10 years ago, they would have been in the mainstream of the Republican Party.
Yeah, and I really kind of felt like telling Steve Bullock, look, why are you here in the Democratic Party? Are you just too scared to go fight for your values in the Republican Party? You'd rather come and try to beat up people you perceive as wimpy Democrats? It's really kind of how he came across to me.
I would say for the week overall, Sanders and Warren the first night, and then Cory Booker and, surprisingly, Jay Inslee had very good nights the second night. Inslee reported record fundraising off of his performance on Wednesday night, and who knows, maybe that will give him enough momentum to qualify for the next debate. He seems to be a long shot at this point, but certainly his emphasis on climate change is well and necessary and will be helpful to have in the field is an ongoing thing. So let's talk about climate change.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. I've been evaluating the presidential candidates one issue at a time. I've been looking at candidates who have gotten more than 2% in the polls. This week, it's the same six candidates as last week with one addition, and I will mention him at the end. Climate change really is, I think, the most urgent issue, more so than just about any other issue up before these presidential candidates this year. And it's important that we look at what specific actions they're talking about taking if they're elected. Environmental activists are calling for net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 at the latest and 100% clean energy as soon as possible. But many of the candidates have not committed to that, and I will talk about them as we go along here. Joe Biden, I refer to him as the clean energy cop. Biden would immediately sign executive orders to limit things like methane emissions for oil and gas companies, to buy electric vehicles for the federal government, to make federal buildings and facilities fuel efficient, et cetera, et cetera. All the things that you would expect from a Democratic president, including protecting the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and other public lands from drilling and fracking, et cetera. Now, he wants to invest in new infrastructure and green technology, including expanding the use of carbon capture technology for power plants and developing small modular nuclear reactors. Yes, carbon capture and nuclear power are definitely still on the table for Joe Biden. He will recommit the U.S. to the Paris Climate Agreement. I think all of these candidates have said that, so I won't repeat it again. He will throw America's economic weight. This is his difference. He'll throw America's economic weight around to try to enforce emissions targets with other countries, including using our trade policy, the IMF debt restructuring program, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, and the Export-Import Bank. Good old mainstream Democrat there. He will direct the EPA and the DOJ, the Department of Justice, to enforce air and water quality standards. He will take other unspecified actions that he didn't detail against fossil fuel companies. He will prioritize new infrastructure and jobs for communities of color and communities impacted by the shift to clean power. And all the other candidates say a similar thing, so I won't repeat that again for them. He will not accept campaign contributions from oil, gas, and coal companies or their executives, and most of the other candidates have said that as well, with a couple of exceptions. The cost of his plan is $1.7 trillion in federal, state, and local government money. So not just $1.7 trillion in federal money over the next decade. He's assuming that governments he can't control at the state and local level will also kick in money. Plus, he's expecting the private sector will kick in $5 trillion, which I wouldn't necessarily count on. So the question is how to pay for it. He would reverse the Trump tax cuts, although I would argue that that just reduces our massive deficit, not necessarily would pay for his climate initiatives. But he would also close unspecified tax loopholes for corporations and the wealthy and end federal subsidies for fossil fuels. So not a lot of details there.
And reversing the tax cuts and closing those loopholes would require the acquiescence
of
the Senate.
Yes, and that's true.
And beating a potential filibuster.
Yeah. All of Congress, yeah. And so that's true for a lot of these candidates. Now, Bernie Sanders, he's the number two in the polls. His idea is to just let's pass the Green New Deal. So he did introduce the Green New Deal into Congress. He co-sponsored it in the Senate. He would invest in infrastructure to protect vulnerable communities, to reduce carbon emissions from transportation sector by expanding high-speed passenger rail, electric vehicles, and public transit. He'd ban fracking, new fossil fuel infrastructure and fossil fuel leases on public lands. He would ban exports of coal, natural gas, and crude oil. And he signed the No Fossil Fuel Money Pledge to not take money from those companies.
As he noted in the debate in response to the ever-irritating John Delaney, I wrote the damn bill.
Yeah, he wrote the bill. So if you want to know his Green New Deal, you go read the bill. But that's really all that he has in terms of specifics that he would do. Sanders has really not yet released a detailed plan for how he would tackle the transition to clean energy, although members of his campaign staff have said that a detailed plan is currently in progress. Now, I just want to point out that over the last 30 years as a senator, Sanders has sponsored or co-sponsored many, many, many bills related to climate change. So we do have a track record of knowing what specific things he would like to do. And some of those bills include the Clean Power Act of 2007 to regulate emissions from fossil fuel power plants, the Climate Protection Act of 2013 to impose a carbon tax on emissions, the End Polluter Welfare Act, which would have ended $130 billion in subsidies to fossil fuel corporations, the 100 by 50 Act to reach 100% renewable energy by 2050. I think he'd probably increase that goal now. And the Keep It in the Ground Act, which is pretty self-explanatory. So, like I said, he has a track record there. But like an old-school socialist, his campaign has really prioritized healthcare and workers' rights above the environment so far. And that could hurt him if he doesn't come out with a more specific climate plan. Now, Elizabeth Warren, her policy I call the name and shame. She also supports the Green New Deal. To get there, she would invest $2 trillion over 10 years for research and development of clean energy technology in the U.S., which can then be marketed and sold abroad as an export industry. $1.5 trillion of that will be used to buy clean technology from U.S. companies for federal, state, and local governments to put to use and to sell for export.
And she's really emphasized that as part of her economic plan
as
well.
She really has, yeah. So how would she get that money? She has proposed a real corporate profits tax on top of the current taxes that some corporations pay, and some corporations pay zero tax. Every dollar over $100 million in profits would be subject to a 7% tax with no exception. For example, just one company, Amazon, would pay $698 million in the first year if that tax were passed, versus $0 in tax that they pay now.
Yes.
And an estimated 1,200 companies would be subject to the tax. So you could ask, why not just raise the corporate tax rate? Because there are so many loopholes in the tax code that companies like Amazon can take advantage of, they will always be able to pay zero tax no matter how high you raise the rates. Warren wants to close those loopholes, but that's going to take years. And we need the money now for climate change. Finally, she has a name and shame policy. She would require all publicly traded companies to publicly disclose their climate-related risks and the benefits to the company of tackling climate change. Fossil fuel companies would have to make the most detailed disclosures. Therefore, investors would want to move their money to safer investments in green technology, and this will pressure dirty industries to either clean up or close down. That's her climate change policy. The cost is $2 trillion, and she'll use a corporate profits tax to pay for it. Now, she has a lot of great plans, but as Joff said, she'd have to get buy-in from Congress. Both the House and the Senate will hinge on that. Now, Kamala Harris, the fourth candidate, she's just a lot more vague statements. So she supports the Green New Deal. She supports a lot of the same things that the other candidates do, but she does not have a detailed plan yet. All she has on her website is some vague statements.
It's really kind of a mess.
Yeah, just like kind of with healthcare, although I'll talk about that a little bit more if we have time. Pete Buttigieg is the fifth candidate. He's the carbon tax guy. His website doesn't contain a distinct climate plan. Instead, he buries it in a section on his national security policies, which is consistent with the fact that he served in the U.S. Navy Reserve and did a seven-month tour in Afghanistan. So he has a very hawkish view of what the entire presidency should be. And it's weird to see the climate plan wrapped into national security, but there it is.
But he does, to his credit, identify climate change as a serious
national
security
issue.
Yeah, unlike
most Republicans, yeah. So in general, he wants a nationwide carbon tax, which would pay dividends to American workers, especially if they've lost their fossil fuel industry jobs or their coal industry jobs. He wants to quadruple federal research into renewable energy and energy storage, but doesn't put a price on it. He wants to invest in building retrofits and energy-efficient homes and decarbonize industries and transportations, et cetera, et cetera. But there are no details on specific steps he would take as president. And again, no estimate of costs. He does mention a carbon tax. However, he doesn't talk about how much it would collect and whether it would be effective. And I think at this point, outright fossil fuel bans or specific emissions targets are really what are needed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, that a carbon tax might be just too slow at this point. The sixth candidate is Beto O'Rourke. His policy is net zero by 2050. He would use his executive authority to re-enter the Paris Climate Agreement to strengthen emissions limits for oil and gas industry and power plants, to strengthen fuel economy standards, et cetera, et cetera. The same thing that all the other candidates say. His first bill to Congress would be a 10-year, $1.5 trillion plan to invest in green infrastructure, and he would fund it by closing tax loopholes on businesses and the wealthy, but he doesn't give specifics. And he thinks this $1.5 trillion will be able to leverage up to $3.5 trillion in additional funding, although, again, he gives no specifics on where that money is going to come from and how it's going to appear out of nowhere. Most importantly, he talks about net zero by 2050, not by 2030, which is the goal of the Green New Deal. Now, his cost of his plan, $1.5 trillion over 10 years, with $3.5 trillion appearing like magic out of nowhere. How to pay for it? Well, not a lot of information on that. We'll just close some tax loopholes and let it go at that. So Beto here falls far short of his reputation for wonkishness. Now, the final candidate who made the cut this week is Cory Booker, and I call his plan Back to the Future. He would do, as president, a lot of the same thing that the others would do, but he talks about it in terms of rolling back Trump administration changes to the Obama era, like undoing the Trump administration environmental deregulation, reauthorizing and tripling the Superfund tax on chemical and oil companies, increasing staff at the EPA, raising standards for granting new Clean Air Act and clean water permits, et cetera, reinstating a crude oil export ban. He would go a little further than the Obama administration in a few areas. He would ban fracking. end federal subsidies for fossil fuel production and end all drilling on public lands.
And those subsidies are huge.
Yeah.
Hundreds of billions of dollars a year.
Yeah. But again, these climate plans go into the trillions of dollars. So you got to have a little more than that. He supports the Green New Deal and was one of the first senators to sign on to it. So we do know what he supports in principle. But again, I want to point out that the Green New Deal is more a statement of intent than actual specifics, which is why it's important to get the specifics from these candidates. Booker has said in the past that he supports a price on carbon, but he has also said that he supports the development of new nuclear technology as a form of clean energy. So keep that in mind. Cost, he provides no information on that. How to pay for it? Not a lot of information on that either. In fact, he really has not a lot of information on any specific plan other than to go back to a lot of pre-Trump era good ideas with a few basic improvements. So just to kind of broad wrap up, the supporters of the Green New Deal are Sanders, Warren, Harris, and Booker. They are committed to the goal of the goals of the Green New Deal, which include cutting total greenhouse gas emissions in half by 2030 and have 100% clean energy production by the year 2030. And that's just 10 years from when they take office. Biden and O'Rourke are committed to net zero emissions by 2050 with no interim goals. That would be 30 years out from when they take office. And that's a timeline that they really will have no control over. And if they don't have interim targets, who's to hold them to any standards in the 4 to 8 years when they're presidents?
It's also way too slow to reverse the current trends in climate change.
Yeah, and Mayor Pete Buttigieg has not yet committed to any goal.
And just to remind people, you know, it's 4 months until the first votes are cast. So mm-hmm. now is the time to pressure these candidates to get specifics, to become more realistic, mm-hmm. and to make real commitments, put forward plans that meet the scale of the crisis.
Yeah, and if you like Mayor Pete Buttigieg, ask him for more details, please, on any of his plans. So far, I haven't seen a whole lot from him, and the same is true for Kamala Harris. I do also want to quickly mention Kamala Harris this week and released her health care plan. We talked about health care plans last week. Her health care plan is, she calls it Medicare for All, which would still allow a role for private insurers. In other words, she wants to expand Medicare Advantage plans, which are provided by private insurers to allow Medicare recipients to use private insurance rather than use the government plan. But I want to point out that Medicare Advantage plans can limit the doctors and facilities that you can use. They also limit the type of treatments you can get and the medicine you can take, just like other private health insurance plans do. And I also want to point out, too, that Medicare Advantage really was a Republican idea that was a way to try to privatize Medicare, and that to see a Democrat release a, quote unquote, Medicare for All plan that relies heavily on Medicare Advantage plans is really, I think, surreal. So I do not like Kamala Harris's health care plan.
Of course, Obamacare was originally a Republican idea, too.
Yes, it was. That's true. Which is why I'm not for Joe Biden's let's shore up Obamacare.
All right. Moving on, FBI comes out this week with some labels.
Yeah, it had an internal report which was leaked, which labeled QAnon and other right-wing conspiracy movements as domestic terror threats. Now, we certainly saw that with the Gilroy shooter this past weekend and a number of other mass shooting incidents over the past year, and the bomber in Florida who was apprehended last year, who targeted a number of leading Democrats. People may remember during the Obama administration, the FBI tried to label right-wing groups as a domestic terror threat and got a huge amount of pushback for it and had to walk that back. So far, at least since this came out yesterday, there has not been a corresponding Republican demand that they shut that down, largely because it's kind of inarguable at this point that those conspiracy movements, the Alex Jones fueled and farther, very, very often web-based movements that they are badly divorced from reality and very violent. And they're very open about that in a lot of their forums. So I'm glad to see the FBI's paying attention to it.
All right. And quickly, we didn't have time for it last week, but UK has a new prime minister.
Yeah, and Boris Johnson took a sort of a victory tour to introduce himself to the voters of Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland this week, and it did not go well. He was met with protesters in all three of those venues. And in all three of those venues, there are a lot of nationalist forces that are talking about leaving the United Kingdom and trying to stay in or rejoin, as the case may be, the European Union. Particularly in Northern Ireland, this is a hot issue because they share a land border with Ireland and will have to erect hard border in order to stay in the UK. That brings back memories of the long-standing Irish Civil War between Northern Ireland, Republican and Loyalist forces, all who are dividing largely along those lines over Brexit. It's a setup, and people in Northern Ireland are very worried about that. And the idea of reunification with the Republic of Ireland is gaining a lot of currency. Similarly, Scotland narrowly lost an independence vote in 2014, and they're now talking about a second independence vote. The Scottish Nationalist Party, which currently controls the Scottish Parliament, is in favor of that and is moving toward it. So we could see Boris Johnson being perhaps the last Prime Minister of the United Kingdom while it is still united. And
maybe in the process of becoming a much smaller Britain.
Yes, or England and Wales, or maybe just England. And that will make Donald Trump and his handler, Vladimir Putin, very happy.
Mm-hmm. All right. And also, quickly, Greenland is very warm.
Oh, yeah.
You want
to talk about that?
Yeah. In June, Greenland experienced temperatures that were 15 to 30 degrees above normal temperatures for July. They experienced 197 billion tons of meltwater in June. So 60% of ice cover has seen some surface melt over the entire island.
That some 200 billion, that's a B, billion, was it gallons or tons?
Tons of meltwater in June.
That actually by itself raised the global sea level by half a millimeter, which is just amazing to consider.
And they're starting to see unpredictable effects, things that climate models can't predict, like wildfires in the mossy fens in West Greenland that can burn into peat bogs and release large amounts more of greenhouse gas from the soil.
That's actually happening in Siberia right now.
Yeah, it's happening in Siberia, but it's happening in Greenland too, something that they've never seen before. And these big meltwater events, these are things that, because they have never happened in the past, climatologists can't build them into their models of what's happening with climate change. There are these big one-off melts, and they can happen. We just don't know when and how and what the triggers are going to be. In this case, a weakening jet stream appears to be part of the issue, a global effect, a weakening jet stream. Typically, weather systems move from the southwest into Greenland. This is the huge hot weather system that brought record triple-digit temperatures to Europe, actually moving westward over Greenland. So the climate system's breaking down there, the jet stream's breaking down there.
And that's almost all the way across the North Atlantic. Greenland's really a part of North America.
Yeah, it is. So, and that's very alarming as well.
Events.
Coming up this weekend, this coming week, is the 74th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And our good friends at the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action are marking that occasion, as they do each August. Right now, between now and Monday, they will be having training and workshops and a direct action on Monday. You can find out more information at gzcenter.org, and they are located at 16159 Clear Creek Road, northwest in Polesbo. That's right across the gates from the Bangor Nuclear Subbase. So go check that out.
On Tuesday, there's a press conference and report back on the progress towards a Green New Deal for Seattle with speakers from Got Green, El Centro de la Raza, and 350 Seattle. That's at 1 p.m. at Seattle City Hall at 600 4th Avenue at James Street downtown. And then next Saturday is a rally to save the Ave from upzoning and gentrification that could tear down the Ave's historic buildings and displace small businesses. That's at 5 p.m. next Saturday at the Big Time Brewery at 4133 University Way Northeast in the U District.
Also, tomorrow from 1 to 4 o'clock, there will be a border resistance speaking tour stopping in Seattle with mutual aid activists from El Paso Juarez and also San Diego's Tijuana. $5 to $20 is a suggested donation, but nobody will be turned away for lack of funds. It'll be at Pipsqueak Gallery, 173 16th Avenue in the CD. And then on Thursday, August 8th, 3:30 in the afternoon, location to be announced, hashtag Never Again Is Now, Jewish communities and their allies are protesting against U.S. border policies. And of course, this Tuesday, as we mentioned at the top of the show, primary ballots are due. Get them in today if you can, if you're going to mail them. And, of course, you can register and vote in person at the King County Administration Building downtown at 5th and 4th, rather, in James.
And also this coming Thursday, vehicle residency, a community conversation will be taking place with some great local speakers at University Heights Center. That starts at 7 p.m. And we'll be taping that and making it available to you at the KODXSeattle.org website. So,
and if you find the information that you heard today valuable, remember the KODX is listener supported and all volunteer, and we can definitely use your financial assistance.
Visit KODXSeattle.org online. There's a Patreon button at the top right, and there's a one-time PayPal donation button further down towards the bottom of the website.
And yes, we're also looking for volunteers. So. Mm-hmm. Always,
oh, hey, that's a good idea, too.
Yeah. And yeah. Tell your friends about this show and about the station. And we can always use more listeners.
Yes, and if you still do personal checks, you can make it out to Earth on the Air Independent Media at P.O. Box
45883.
Seattle, Washington.
98145.
Awesome.
All right. So we'll see you all. We'll see you two next Saturday.
Yes, we'll be here.
We'll be here.